one knock-on effect from the war in Ukraine, a new sudden interest in Ukrainian history, culture, and writing.
I think Ukraine was just dismissed as these backwaters of Russia.
No longer. Also on the show, we continue our look at how wars end. Today, Operation Desert Storm and the lessons learned from the first Gulf War.
We're not going to win wars simply by smashing the enemy. We need to think about and put resources into what follows. And that's really the great failure.
I'm Marco Werman, and the summer tourist stampede in Venice, Italy, gets worse each year for locals. Authorities plan to charge a fee to day trippers to encourage them to stay longer and spend more money. Residents say they just want life the way it used to be.
Local businesses, children playing in the squares.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. Another scary moment in the war in Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia have been trading blame today for shelling in and around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The facility is currently occupied by Russian forces, but is located in territory that Ukraine is trying to take back. To state the obvious, the risks associated with fighting near a nuclear power plant are extremely high. With us to discuss all this is Jason J. Smart. He's a correspondent with the Kyiv Post and joins us from Washington. What more details can you give us about what exactly is happening at the site?
What's happening now is Russia has taken siege of the plant. They control it. They have Ukrainians inside operating it. But the day-to-day cycle has been completely disturbed by Russia's occupation of the territory, which recently has been shelled. As you mentioned, the Ukrainians blame the Russians blame the Ukrainians. But it would appear it's most likely it's the Russians themselves creating fires near the plant in order to stoke the tension that is already obviously existent. Just breaking news a little while ago was that there is more fires that broke out around the plant, and even the workers who were scheduled to arrive to the plant today were sent home, and the ones who are currently on shift stayed due to the fact that the fires were so intense.
So the Russians are holding the plant, Russian forces are holding the plant, and they're physically on site, and Ukrainian forces are trying to dislodge them by shelling them, and the Russians are firing back. Is that kind of the scene?
No, the Ukrainians are not shelling them, specifically because the Russians took the plant for two reasons. One is that it produces energy, obviously, and the Russians are trying to divert that energy, it appears, to Crimea, which is the occupied area in the southern part of Ukraine. The second reason that they're occupying it is because it's the best place from which they can shell Ukrainian positions, because the Ukrainians will not fire on the nuclear facility. That is, the Russians essentially are treating the nuclear facility as a hostage.
And as you said, there are now fires. I mean, how likely is it for this fighting around the site to cause any kind of nuclear disaster?
Well, there was fires last week and again now, but the chances of a disaster are existent. I mean, it's not grave, but it is quite existent. Most likely, it would not be something like a huge mushroom cloud, but the leak of radiation, especially if something were to happen, such as energy to the plant is disturbed or water to the cooling of the plant is disturbed, this could cause a meltdown of one of the reactors.
Jason, what do we know about people who live around or near this plant?
So I've interviewed people that are near the plant and in the vicinity, and they've said that there's been a rush on iodine pills, that they're no longer available in the pharmacies, and that there is a great deal of concern of radiation. Keep in mind, Ukraine was also the location of the worst nuclear disaster in history at Chernobyl in 1986. And so the memory of that, this silent killer of radiation that's not visible but is quite lethal, is something that's very real for Ukrainians.
What is each side saying right now about this situation?
Well, the Ukrainian side has been seeking international assistance and has requested already the International Atomic Agency to come and to assist. Russia has just continued to refuse to allow further inspection and has not been willing to agree to demilitarize the nuclear power plant.
So is there anyone who can approach both sides and say, you know, the risks are too great here, you really don't want this?
You know, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency was supposed to meet today with the Security Council members of the United Nations to discuss this and hoping to get support from them. In his own words, the situation at the plant is completely out of control and it's taking serious risk in playing with nuclear fire.
So the UN has urged both sides to stop the fighting around the plant. The IAEA wants inspectors to go in. What potential solutions are being discussed about how to resolve this?
Well, that's the problem, is that right now it doesn't look like there's a serious solution at hand. The United States has said that it supports demilitarization. of the facility. The reality is that the Russians couldn't care less, that the Americans agree with that. But right now, there is not a clear solution ahead. And eventually, this will only worsen as Ukraine continues to push east to liberate the rest of the occupied territories. That will not be an island of Russian-held land. I mean, Russia at some point will have to give and either abandon the plant or do something dramatic with it.
Jason, there has been major fighting at the site before. Is this something you think we're likely to continue to see as long as this war goes on?
As long as the war continues, I think that there is a good chance that there'll be continued fighting near the plant. And once again, the problem is not necessarily the direct threat of being shelled. As I said, the Ukrainians are not firing on the plant. The serious threat is simply that Russia is taken as a hostage. And if it feels that it's losing territory, what it could do to the plant is a question.
Definitely a troubling situation. Jason J. Smart, a correspondent with Ukrainian news site Kyiv Post. He joined us from Washington. Jason, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Soon we'll be marking half a year since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. One effect of this conflict is being felt in the world of literature. The war has prompted a wave of interest in Ukrainian writing, as well as history and culture. That has publishers scrambling. As The World's Daniel Hoffman reports, Ukrainian translators are now working overtime.
Boris Dralyuk is an LA-based writer, editor, poet, and translator. Dralyuk grew up in Ukraine, and when he was 8, his family moved from the southern port city of Odessa to the Pacific shores of Los Angeles.
I see myself as a man of many hyphens, former Soviet, Jewish, Odessan, Ukrainian, American, Angelino. All of these things I feel I embrace.
When Dralyuk first came to the U.S., he wanted to assimilate as quickly as possible. But it didn't take long for him to want to reconnect his family roots. So before he was even a teenager, he started reading, writing, and translating poetry from Russian into English.
I felt that the work I was translating, even at a very young age, was really my work. Every English word was a word that I had chosen. I felt a great pride in it.
That pride carried over to his studies in college. And these days, he translates poetry and literature from both Russian and Ukrainian into English. Dralyuk defines it as an art of expression, but also diplomacy.
So I feel that you're using all of the resources at hand as a writer, all of the talent that you have as a writer, but you're also serving as a diplomat, as an ambassador for this foreign text and for the culture that it represents.
Dralyuk says this has become even more important since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because the war is driving demand for Ukrainian publications.
I'm contacted every day by an author or a publication asking for a new translation, asking to consult about translators. It's been really incessant. It's also extremely encouraging.
The demand for new Ukrainian literature and new translations is something that Polina Lavrova is responding to as well. She's the director and owner of Laurus, a Kyiv-based publishing house.
Очень много стало заказов на книг, причем на книг совершенно неожиданных, то есть как бы те, которые продавались, есть такие медленные книги, это...
Lavrova says book orders are up right now. She says many people in Ukraine are displaced, out of work, and they're looking for a distraction. So they're turning to books.
Украинские вообще был больше запрос там начиная с года даже на 17-го. Не после.
For years, a lot of books in Ukraine were printed in Russia, but now Lavrova says many Ukrainians refuse to buy books published there. They want to buy Ukrainian ones.
Цепочка должна быть не нарушена, потому что нарушается одно звено и все может посыпаться.
Lavrova says publishing houses in Ukraine are struggling to keep up with demand. The supply chain is in shambles. Some printing houses were destroyed by Russian missiles. Paper costs are way up, and writers, editors, and translators are often just trying to get by. Zenya Tompkins is a literary translator with a nonprofit called TALT, the Tompkins Agency for Ukrainian Literature and Translation.
I'm not accepting any book projects before 2024 at this point personally. You know, I think the stronger translators are in similar positions.
Publishers are trying to speed up the process, but Tompkins says it takes a long time to properly translate a book, and that costs money.
You know, on our end in the last year, we've had two translators quit part-time jobs to be able to translate full-time.
Tompkins and her organization are part of a trend, stepping in to meet the rising demand for Ukrainian literature. It wasn't that long ago, she says, when publishers were not so interested.
It does feel like for some reason, the world wasn't noticing Ukraine as a cultural country. I don't think I've really processed this until recent weeks, that I think Ukraine was just dismissed as these backwaters of Russia.
Tompkins grew up in a Ukrainian diaspora community in New Jersey. In recent years, she's also gotten close with people from Ukraine's literary scene. So for her, translations are not just about doing business.
That's what keeps me motivated to translate, is the satisfaction of those personal relationships and knowing that I'm taking the work of someone who I very much admire and respect and giving them a bigger stage to stand on. So it's not this weird abstract mission. It's very much, I'm doing this for my friends at this point. I mean, I'm doing this for some of the most important people in my life.
Zenia Tompkins tells me she worries that the Ukraine she remembers from years past is being destroyed. And even though there's a war, she hopes to return for a visit as soon as she can. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
War, a pandemic, scorching temperatures, and if that wasn't enough, the Earth itself is spinning faster. The world's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The Earth takes 24 hours to spin around. Everybody knows that. But on June 29th, the globe posted a personal best. It shaved 1.59 milliseconds off its usual time. That Wednesday was the shortest day on record since scientists started measuring this stuff in the 1960s. The Earth's rotation around its axis, which determines how long a day is, has been speeding up over the past few decades. In 2020, we had 28 of the shortest days in the past 50 years. Scientists say, don't worry about it. But given the way the world has been going, pardon me for needing just an extra bit of reassurance.
There's no reason for panic.
This is Stephen Merkowitz at NASA. He says the Earth's rotation naturally fluctuates for all kinds of reasons.
From the weather to earthquakes, volcanoes, tectonic motion.
So while we might have learned in kindergarten that a day is 24 hours, that's not strictly true. Wind the clock back 1.4 billion years, give or take, a day was less than 19 hours long. When dinosaurs roamed the Earth, days were 23 and a half hours long. In other words,
it's been going on since forever.
But back in the Cretaceous period, they didn't have delightful memes about the Earth speeding up. A user named MWES posted, "If we all jump at the same time, will that help? Not a bad idea." And then my favorite, "They just said the Earth was spinning faster and no one cares." That's 2022 for you. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum. Stop the world, 'cause I wanna get out with you. Stop the world, 'cause I wanna get out with you.
This world will keep on spinning at our usual pace. Just ahead, Venice is looking for ways for tourists to love the city just a little more gently. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Each year, Venice, Italy welcomes more than 20 million tourists to marvel at a place where canals take the place of streets. For a while now, Venetians have been complaining that their unique city has been overwhelmed with visitors. Venice is now dealing with the problem by introducing a new fee for day trippers. Critics say it's unlikely to make a difference. From Venice, John Last reports.
In a small shop tucked away on one of Venice's many narrow streets, Maria Teresa Laghi sells fine pottery to Venetians and tourists alike.
I sell many things, and I sell not touristic things, unusual things.
Laghi is a lifelong Venetian. Her store's been here for more than two decades. And in that time, a lot has changed about the city she calls home.
I remember a different Venice, of course. It was more troop. I think that Venice not lose the soul, but sold the soul. And this is very sad for us Venetians.
When Laghi was growing up here, it was still easy to find a local butcher or grocería. A young couple could hope to rent a house here to start their family. But not anymore. As tourism has exploded, hotels and tacky souvenir stores have proliferated on every corner. Rents have skyrocketed. Now, she says, there's little of the real Venice left.
Venetians are not no more in Venice.
That has the city resorting to some new measures to check the unrelenting flow of tourists. First, there was a ban on new fast food restaurants, then one on cruise ships and cheap trinket shops, and finally, the latest.
Eravamo prossimi all'avvio di questa grande rivoluzione, sostanzialmente.
After years and years of talking about it, the city is finally introducing a fee for so-called day trippers, visitors to the city who don't spend a night in a local hotel. Those hoping to stop briefly in the city or its islands will soon need to pay a daily fee of between 3 and 10 euro, depending on just how full the city is that day. The money will go towards cleaning up after the visitors. Fail to pay, and you could be hit with a fine of up to 300 euro if one of the dozen or so inspectors sees you don't have a ticket. Here at the train station, counselors are even talking about putting in turnstiles and checkpoints to separate tourists from locals. They've tried it once before, in 2018, but they were torn down in protest. And today, many in the tourism industry remain skeptical of the plan.
Do you want to do the cicadas or me?
In Venice's shady Giardini, I met with Luisella Romeo. Born and raised in the city, she's guided tours here for 22 years.
I think that it's just fake news. Believe me, it's only fake news. There won't be any turnstiles.
Romeo isn't alone in believing the plan, as described, will likely never come to pass. The implementation of the new system has already been delayed twice. In that time, it's gone from being mandatory to optional, at least to start. Instead of fines for non-payers, those who pre-book and pay the fee will get discounts and incentives at the local museums. But Romeo says even if it's made mandatory, it likely won't make a difference to the city's overwhelming flow of tourists. Venice is already a pretty expensive place to visit.
No tourists will say no to a fee, also because within their budget, this is going to affect very, very little.
Admission increase this year, the Doge's Palace will become the most expensive museum in all of Europe. The city's restaurants and hotels are already some of the priciest in Italy. A 10-euro fee is unlikely to make much of a difference in a traveler's budget. And those who will be priced out, Romeo says, aren't necessarily the ones causing Venice's problems.
The problem is who you are cutting off. I cannot tell that the ones staying in the very expensive hotels are more intellectually curious than the ones that come here and decide to sleep on a bus because they cannot afford the hotel, but they go and visit all the museums in one day.
For Laghi, the shopkeeper, and Romeo alike, the important thing is that tourists come to Venice with a sense of respect and a desire for discovery, not to snap a single selfie, buy a cheap souvenir, and call it a day. They say new rules and regulations should really focus more on preserving what space remains for the city's authentic local life.
Children playing in the squares, local businesses, the sense of being among a familiar rather than being in a fake place, a sort of a Venice land rather than a city.
For now, the new fee system is set to start January 16th. An online portal on the city's website will eventually allow visitors to pre-book. Romeo is already scheduling tours into January. Like others in the industry I contacted, she says she's received no communication from the city on how to advise her customers about the fee. The city didn't respond to any requests for comment. For Venice's guides and for would-be visitors, it's a case of wait and see. In the meantime, the city's streets and canals are fuller than ever. For The World, I'm John Last in Venice, Italy.
Early this summer, a team of naturalists trekked to the longest mountain range in Haiti in search of an elusive flowering tree, the native northern magnolia. It had not been documented for nearly a century. After 3 days of tough hikes, they reached a remote flank of the range and glimpsed what they came looking for. Find our story about rediscovering a lost species on our website, theworld.org. In Beirut today, a man with a gun went into a bank on busy Hamra Street, and he took several people hostage. This was not a regular bank heist, though. 42-year-old Bassam Al-Sheikh Hussein was demanding that the bank allow him to withdraw his own money. This is from a video taken by one of the hostages and posted on social media. It shows a bearded man holding a rifle and telling bank employees to release about $200,000 from his own savings. Hussein said he needed the money to pay for surgery for his father. But why a withdrawal at gunpoint? In 2019, when Lebanon's financial crisis began, banks imposed a limit on foreign currency withdrawals, tying up millions of dollars worth of savings. This was not the first time someone tried to withdraw money by force. Last January, a coffee shop owner in eastern Lebanon managed to take out $50,000 from his account, again by taking bank employees hostage. Some in Lebanon worry that this will only encourage more lawlessness and violence. Others see these bank robbers as heroes. Today, as the news about the hostage situation on Hamra Street spread, people gathered outside the bank. Some chanted anti-government slogans. Rows of riot police stood between the crowd and the entrance of the bank. Roughly 7 hours into the ordeal, negotiators managed to convince Hussein to leave the bank and release all the hostages. Journalists gathered outside the bank, capturing the moment Hussein was escorted out by security. According to the Reuters news agency, authorities agreed to let him withdraw some frozen funds. No one was hurt today, but the episode was another reminder of the dire economic situation in Lebanon. The country's currency has lost 90% of its value. An estimated 3/4 of the population is living in poverty. More stories from around the globe are still coming your way in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. A museum in Sweden is dedicated to showing off some of the world's greatest product flops. Consider a revolutionary toothbrush.
Super vibrates for 10 seconds and supposedly cleans your entire mouth in 10 seconds. The problem is it doesn't actually work.
And that's nothing compared to some of the other losers on display. The Museum of Failure, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. How do wars end? We've been trying to answer that this week by taking a deep dive into several conflicts. Today, we turn the clock back to 1991 and the first Gulf War in Iraq. This story, like the others you've heard in our series, was reported in 2008, but the takeaways are still very resonant today. Here again is Jeb Sharp.
When U.S. troops returned from the Persian Gulf in 1991, they were treated to victory celebrations and a ticker tape parade. It was the parade Vietnam War veterans never got. In his autobiography, Colin Powell describes the thrill of riding up Broadway in New York in a 1959 Buick convertible. He and other architects of the Gulf War had cut their teeth in Vietnam. In planning the engagement with Iraq, they had one overriding goal. This war would be short and sweet. The crisis began when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait on August 2, 1990. Over the next few months, the United States worked to build an international coalition to take action against Iraq. In January 1991, Operation Desert Storm began.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
President George H.W. Bush stressed that the action had the consent of the United Nations and Congress. He said the goal was to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and he promised that the coalition would act quickly and forcefully.
I've told the American people before that this will not be another Vietnam. And I repeat this here tonight. Our troops will have the best possible support in the entire world, and they will not be asked to fight with one hand tied behind their back.
The president was able to keep his promise. In little over a month, he was back in front of the cameras.
Kuwait is liberated. Iraq's army is defeated. Our military objectives are met.
These were short sentences used to describe a short campaign. 6 weeks of air attacks, and a mere 4 days of ground operations. And when he addressed the troops by radio a couple of days later, the president proclaimed that the ghosts of that previous conflict had been exorcised.
The specter of Vietnam has been buried forever in the desert sands of the Arabian Peninsula.
The men who prosecuted the 1991 Gulf War were deeply influenced by Vietnam. At the time, Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He played a key role in ensuring the war was brought to a swift end. General Norman Schwarzkopf remembers feeling relieved and surprised by the speed of the conclusion.
All of us were stunned by the fact that we had achieved victory so quickly with such a low loss of life on the part of our forces. And it took a very long time for that to sink in. I mean, we had won a stunning victory at almost no cost, relatively speaking. And every one of us was kind of walking around weeks later still shaking our head, not, you know, afraid that you were going to wake up from this wonderful dream you were having and find yourself in a nightmare.
The end game was not a nightmare for the Americans, but it turned into one for the Iraqis. During the conflict, President Bush had encouraged the Iraqi people to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, at the end of the war, Iraqi Kurds and Iraqi Shiites tried to do so. But having called for the Iraqi people to rise up, the first Bush administration then abandoned them. Saddam's forces crushed the rebellions, killing tens of thousands of people. U.S. forces still on the ground in Iraq stood by and watched. Peter Galbraith is a former U.S. diplomat and the author of two books about Iraq.
So what had been a brilliant military campaign and a great success at the end of February began to look like a fiasco at the end of March.
Galbraith should know. In the late 1980s, he was instrumental in documenting Saddam Hussein's atrocities against his own citizens. At the end of the Gulf War, the Iraqi leader's ability to crush the internal rebellions was made easier by a fatal mistake on the part of the Americans. During ceasefire talks, Iraqi military leaders asked General Schwarzkopf for an exemption in order to use their helicopters. Their bridges were all destroyed, they argued, and they needed to ferry officials around the country. Schwarzkopf was later interviewed about it.
That seemed like a reasonable request, and within my charter, I felt that that was something that it was perfectly all right to grant.
But instead of using the helicopters to transport government officials, the Iraqis used them to gun down civilians. Schwarzkopf said he felt used.
I think I was suckered, because I think they intended right then when they asked that question to use those helicopters against the insurrections.
But Peter Galbraith says Schwarzkopf's justifications were absurd. He says U.S. commanders should have responded as soon as they realized what was happening.
After all, for a victorious power dictating the terms to allow an exception for helicopters to fly government officials around doesn't mean that you've made an exception to allow them to use those helicopters to gun down civilians. And so that really was inexcusable. I think it was inattention. I think it was really a focus that their minds were someplace else. They wanted this thing to be over.
Everyone wanted the war to be over, especially President Bush. But there were some missing parts to this ending. At a White House briefing, the president made it clear to reporters that he felt something wasn't quite right.
You know, to be very honest with you, I haven't yet felt this wonderfully euphoric feeling that many of the American people feel. You mentioned World War II. There was a definitive end to that conflict. And now we have Saddam Hussein still there.
Not only was the Iraqi leader still in power, his army was not destroyed. The game plan had been to deprive Saddam of his troops by surrounding them as they fled Kuwait and forcing them to surrender. But then Washington became fixated on ending the ground war at 100 hours. General Schwarzkopf himself declared the gates closed. But in fact, there were gaps in the line, and Iraqi Republican Guard units were streaming northward out of the clutches of coalition forces. Bernard Traynor is co-author of The General's War. He says letting the Iraqi troops flee like that handed Saddam Hussein a propaganda victory.
He then turned around and made his defeat into a victory by telling the Iraqi people and the Arab world that his army had stopped the Americans at the Euphrates River line, and therefore he was the victor in the mother of all battles. It was a pure lie, but we never understood that you must make your enemy know that he is defeated by having him admit his defeat.
There are plenty of people who argue the United States should have fought on in 1991. But Peter Galbraith says that whole debate is a red herring.
There was no need for U.S. troops to go on to Baghdad. The U.S. simply could have enforced the ceasefire that Iraq had already accepted. Specifically, insisted that Iraq not fly its helicopters, not use them for military purposes, and that Iraq not move its tanks and other military units.
Galbraith believes that had the United States done so, the internal uprisings would have succeeded, and Saddam Hussein would have been ousted there and then. In Galbraith's view, the leadership in Washington lost sight of what it was fighting for.
It was an odd moment. After all, the first President Bush compared Saddam Hussein to Adolf Hitler. And then he simply allowed the man he called the Hitler of the Middle East to engage in mass murder against his own people. There was a real disconnect between the rhetoric and the arguments for the war and the reality on the ground.
Several weeks after he'd announced the war over, President Bush found himself on the defensive.
Of course I feel a frustration and a sense of grief for the innocents that are being killed brutally. But we are not there to intervene, and that is not our purpose. It never was our purpose. I do not want to see us get sucked into the internal civil war inside of Iraq.
But in the end, the humanitarian catastrophe proved too large to ignore. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Kurds fled over the border into Turkey, where they struggled to survive in refugee camps. The United States launched Operation Provide Comfort to deliver aid to them. Months after the war was officially over, the U.S. used its troops to carve out safe havens in northern Iraq so that the Kurds could return to their homes. Here was the mission creep that President Bush had sought so hard to avoid. It was certainly a much messier ending than promised. But political scientist Stephen Biddle says we shouldn't expect neat endings in war. He himself even shies away from using words like victory or defeat.
Most wars don't end with this kind of extreme, binary, one-sided outcome. They generally end up in some sort of negotiated deal which secures neither side's war aims completely. Our most important war aim was unambiguously secured. Saddam Hussein did not have control of Kuwaiti oil fields after 1991. But there were a variety of other war aims that lots of Americans thought were worthwhile that were not secured, and the result wasn't as happy for us as many had expected it to be.
The United States ended up maintaining forces in the region for years to come. It also patrolled the skies over Iraq, launching sporadic airstrikes against Iraqi targets. 12 years after the Gulf conflict, it went to war against Iraq again. For Peter Galbraith, there's an eerie parallel between the two wars. In his view, both Bush administrations paid too much attention to their military campaigns and not enough to securing important political objectives in the aftermath.
We're not going to win wars simply by smashing the enemy. We can't eradicate the enemy. We need to think about and be able to plan and put resources into what follows. And that's really the great failure. And it's an incredibly costly failure.
And one that ultimately made Iraq feel a lot more like Vietnam than the Gulf War planners of 1991 ever intended. For the World, I'm Jeb Sharp.
Tomorrow, the conclusion of our series, How Wars End, we look back at the Bosnia War and the Dayton Peace Accords. Afro-Andean funk. It sounds like it could be a musical style, which is not incorrect. It's also the name of a duo that's only been around for 2 years or so.
Para los dolores, agua del olvido. Para el mal de amores, agua del olvido. Para el que ha sufrido, agua del olvido. Si guardas rencores, agua del olvido.
The subjects they sing about are wide-ranging, but they often come back to themes around Peruvian shamanism, as in this track, Agua del Olvido, or Water of Oblivion, about magical waters in Peru used for healing.
Los celos te matan, agua del olvido, traumas de la infancia, agua del olvido.
Singer Araceli Poma and musician Matt Garrity are Afro-Andean Funk. They're in New York. Hello to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
So this project of yours, The Sacred Leaf, it's inspired, I understand, by the coca leaf. Araceli, why is the coca leaf sacred?
The sacred leaf, it is very important because it is the connection with my grandmother. I think that I have the responsibility to spread my culture that my grandmothers gave me.
Araceli's grandmother actually read coca leaves, kind of like reading tarot cards in a way, but a way that people would be able to resolve some of their issues and get guidance from the sacred plant. And that's what we called the album, but then also the first track, which is also called Sacred Leaf, where Araceli sings in Quechua. The preservation of the language of her grandmother was also a key theme that we wanted. So that's on a couple of tunes where we have lyrics in Quechua.
Hazlia sortichata, aparicha indiña jamujma. Kuka kintucha.
We're talking before the interview about your current home, Long Island City in Queens, New York. There's a lot of Spanish spoken there, you said. Do you also hear Quechua these days?
Oh, yeah. I am taking classes of Quechua. I practice with my grandmother and say, alguien poncha o alguien yanchu. For my grandmother is, oh my God, it's really incredible that one person talk with her in her native language. No?
So what did you just say in Quechua?
Oh, alguien ponchao is buenos días.
Alguien ponchao.
Yeah, good job. Alguien ponchao. Yeah. It means good morning.
Matt Garrity, let's talk about the sound of Afro-Andean funk. Where do the band's musical influences come from?
What we've done with Afro-Andean funk is gone deep on Peruvian roots music. The beautiful thing about Araceli's musical heritage is that she comes from both the Andean culture as well as the Afro-Peruvian roots culture. So we have been bridging the gap between those two worlds within Peru to music that is, you know, I feel most passionate about, that I've been focusing on for years. That's world music, funk, rock, jazz, and finding those commonalities through our original compositions. And I feel like there is a real desire to show by mixing these styles and finding artists from Haiti to be special guests like Mono Beats. One of our goals with this album is to show how what you get as a result of uniting cultures, and I think that's at the core of the reason that we created this project.
Given the increasing number of Quechua speakers in New York City that we were just talking about, I'm wondering how you kind of talk to both audiences, the audiences that are interested in Afro-Andean side of things, as well as the audiences that are interested in the funk side of things.
It is a challenge because obviously a lot of people in New York City and in Peru too can understand Quechua and can understand Spanish, but I don't want to have fear. I only want to connect with my heart, with my passion. For me, it is not easy to stay in front of you to talk in English, but it is important to me because it is the form that people know about my Peruvian culture.
I like that. Be fearless. The album is The Sacred Leaf by the duo Afro-Andean Funk, Araceli Poma and Matt Garrity. Thank you so much. All the best to you and your music.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. In northwest Spain this week, helicopters scrambling to extinguish fires. Across Europe, extreme heat has been wreaking havoc this summer. It's led to thousands of excess deaths and has pushed some infrastructure to the breaking point. In Germany, for example, drought is making the Rhine River unnavigable for some barges. Joining me now from Copenhagen to discuss what's going on is Wouter Vanneville. He's a climate change adaptation expert at the European Environment Agency. So just how bad has the heat been this year in Europe? Have you ever seen anything like it, Wouter?
I think, first of all, when it comes to rainfall records, I think already since the beginning of this year, we have really a deficit rainfall. There were several record heat waves. Temperatures were reached that were never reached before. It's now going to agricultural droughts. It's also going to transport, which means the Rhine, where you cannot navigate, but also many other canals and rivers where you have similar issues. And then, of course, it also comes to electricity. Hydropower is, of course, the most direct one, but also all regular energy production, gas, coal, and so on, they need quite a lot of water for cooling towers.
So impacting really everything from agriculture to the electrical grid. We're also seeing these disturbing numbers that more than 2,000 people died of heat-related deaths. That's last month in Spain and Portugal alone. How does that happen? Are people dying in hospitals? Are they overcome by heat and found lifeless later in their homes?
It's a little bit a mixture of many things. In the past, it was mainly elderly in elderly homes. But those organizations, they learned over the years how to adapt. For example, in France, it's mandatory that you have a room that is actively air conditioned for each X number of inhabitants. So now it's indeed more shifting to elderly that are living alone, that are living at home, that don't feel thirsty, that forget to drink. And it's more those individuals rather than the elderly homes where they are adapting to these situations.
So the climate change connections are now pretty well established with these heat waves. But just in the short term, what can countries do to prevent this?
Especially when it comes to drought, I think we should act very early on the demand of water only, but you also need to work on the availability. And that, of course, means that you need to capture it on the moment that it falls. Heat waves, droughts, forest fires, it are three different natural hazards, but of course there are connections in between them.
Do you think enough is being done to plan for the future? Not just ways of keeping people cool in these heat waves, but ways of adapting to prevent fatalities?
Over the last decade, we're really improving our plans, and we're good in the whole planning phase. But what we need to do now is speeding up the whole implementation phase of this. And there are a lot of good local initiatives that are taken, but rather than keeping them at local level, it's scaling up and making sure that they are regionalized and that we roll out what is in all those plans on a much larger scale than is done so far.
So you said this autumn could end up being dry as well. What are you hoping is in place next summer, which one could predict will be as bad or worse as this summer?
That's a very difficult question. I don't think there are many long-term models that really say something already about next year. Of course, what you know is that over time, we will have situations like this more often. That doesn't mean it will be the summer of 23, even not the summer of 24, but it means that a situation like in 22, you need to be prepared much more often than you were in the past, which also means that many of these emergency measures, you need to transfer them into permanent things because they will become economically beneficial to have them in place permanently. We need to be prepared that this will happen much more often, not necessarily the next year, not necessarily the next 2 years, but certainly in a decade, something that was very exceptional and happened once every 50 years, now can happen in the future several times, up to several times per decade.
Wouter Vanneville is a climate change adaptation expert at the European Environment Agency. He's in Copenhagen. Wouter, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Museums are often curated to show off the world's best, whether it's fine art, fashion, science, or just esoterica. But that is decidedly not what you'll find if you walk into the museum featured in this next story. The World's Bianca Hillier explains.
For many people, the idea of failing isn't a laughing matter. But when other people come up short and their products are on display at the Museum of Failure, it's a whole different ballgame.
It is often funny because some of the things are just so stupid.
Samuel West is a clinical psychologist and innovation researcher. He started the Museum of Failure in Sweden back in 2017. Inside, visitors will find more than 150 products, including beef-flavored bottled water for dogs, Harley-Davidson perfume,
legendary Harley-Davidson aux toilettes pour hommes,
and a golf club that doubles as a urinal. It's called the Euro Club, and it even ended up on Shark Tank, where entrepreneurs pitch their ideas.
If you've been on a golf course, I won't have to convince you that trees are sparse and the bathrooms are almost non-existent.
Uh-oh. I can't wait.
I see where this is going.
Believe it or not, that golf club is still on the market. Since the museum's launch, the collection has traveled to L.A., Paris, Taipei, and Calgary, to name a few. Founder Samuel West says many of the items stay the same, but some are switched out.
For example, some of the American brands, they're totally not recognizable in China. Lifesavers is one.
Lifesavers, the hard ring-shaped candy.
So Lifesavers launched a candy that was the Lifesaver holes, like donut holes, but Lifesaver holes.
The huge taste of Lifesavers candy in tiny, delicious little bites.
Yeah, that one was a failure, but the Chinese market doesn't even know what Lifesavers are, so wouldn't work.
Market recognition isn't always a prerequisite. To make it into the museum, the product has to be a failure, of course.
But it also has to be an innovation. So it has to be where people actually were pushing the boundaries.
West says he always has his eyes open for failed products and companies, but the museum's collection mostly comes through donations.
I probably get 2 donations a month. Sometimes it comes from ex-employees from the companies. And then I've been contacted by companies that offered to send their competition's products to the museum.
One product recently donated to the museum is the Unobrush.
It's a revolutionary toothbrush. You stick it in your mouth, then it super vibrates for 10 seconds and supposedly cleans your entire mouth in 10 seconds. The problem is it doesn't actually work.
West laughs, but says all of these companies deserve credit for taking risks with innovative products. At the end of the day, the museum isn't about making fun of the inventions. It's about using them to normalize failure.
I wish people would understand that the rewards of taking a risk are far greater than the pain or discomfort of failure.
He knows failure isn't necessarily a positive thing, but it can be worthwhile. And maybe worthy of a joke or two. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nanabil Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman, back with you again tomorrow.